Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Today, I want to do a debrief episode of the recent dialogue that I had with John Gleason, a.k.a. the Godless Engineer, on the historical reliability of Luke's gospel. I've done a lot of these debriefs after debates and dialogues, and the purpose of these debriefs is not to go back through the entire exchange or to continue the exchange or anything like that. My goal
is to gloat.
Right. Or to do that, as my colleague here has let us know what we're not doing. What I want to do, what Jimmy and I are going to do, and that's why I'm really excited to have Jimmy Akin, a senior apologist to Catholic Answers, to join me. The goal, what I want to do is to expand upon some of the things that were brought up in the dialogue, because both John and I have read a lot on New Testament studies, historiography, things like that, you know, the existence of Jesus. We've read a lot of different areas. And when two people have read a lot in different subjects and they talk to one another, sometimes people listening to it from the outside, well, I believe that there is an expression for this, I guess. Inside baseball would be the expression. It's like, oh, you're throwing around a lot of different terms. What exactly are some of these things you're talking about? And I thought it'd be fun, Jimmy, to bring you on to discuss some of that. So, Jimmy, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here again and looking forward to doing some inside baseball with deep cuts into dank New Testament scholarship memes.
I like it. So yeah, that's what we're going to talk about today. For those of you who haven't watched the dialogue, be sure to go and check it out. I'm releasing it right now, just 5 minutes before this episode. So if you haven't seen it, you should definitely watch it. But you might also benefit from listening to our debrief first, so you can understand the concepts that John and I were disagreeing about, and then go and listen to it. But it's also fine if you've heard it and want a little more elucidation of the terms that were brought up. So, Jimmy, what I want to start with is that the dialogue topic that John and I agreed about originally, he asked me to go on his atheist YouTube channel, Godless Engineer, to talk about slavery in the Old Testament and the commands of the Israelites to conquer and kill neighboring Canaanite tribes. And so I just told John right off the bat, I don't know if you and I could have a good dialogue on those issues, because there's so many things we disagree about. You know, if he doesn't even believe that God exists, for example, we're going to have a hard time coming together on this. So that's why I chose a narrower topic, even though we were still kind of far apart, which would be the historical reliability of Luke's gospel, because he had just done a video on that. Could you comment a little bit on the importance of, when we're dialoguing or debating with people, not being too far away from them, so to speak, on the subjects we dialogue about?
Yeah, it makes sense when doing debates and or debate-like discussions to have a certain amount of common ground so that you have a common frame of reference for discussing a subject. Otherwise, it can be very challenging. For example, I would not debate a Protestant on the Assumption of Mary, because the doctrine of the Assumption of Mary is based on more than just Scripture. I wouldn't pretend that I can prove it from Scripture alone, but since Protestants are coming from a sola scriptura framework, where they want to say that you have to be able to prove everything from Scripture alone, and I don't think you can do that for the Assumption of Mary. You need to be able to appeal to tradition and the magisterium. I wouldn't personally enter into a debate like that with a Protestant, at least typically. Similarly, I wouldn't debate a Jehovah's Witness on the question of, does Jesus have one will or two? That was a controversy at a certain point in church history, and the Orthodox Christian teaching is that since Jesus is fully God and fully man, he must have both a divine will and a human will. They're not in conflict with each other, but they both must be there. And that's a position known as diotheletism, from duo means two, and Thelema means will. So diothelitism is the idea Jesus has two wills. But I wouldn't debate that with a Jehovah's Witness because they don't believe that Jesus is both God and man.
Right.
They think he's an angel. And so we don't really share enough common ground to be able to discuss that productively. In the case of your discussion with Godless Engineer, you do have some common ground. You know, you both believe that there's this early Christian document known as the Gospel of Luke, and that it was written, you know, either within the first century or very shortly thereafter, and that it relates ideas about the life and ministry of Jesus of Nazareth. And so you've got something of a common ground there, which allowed you to discuss a lot of things. It was still somewhat challenging, though, in that he's coming from a mythicist perspective, meaning
right.
he doesn't even believe Jesus exists, whereas you're coming from a perspective that's going to not only say Jesus exists, but that the Gospel of Luke is actually quite good as a record. But because he views Luke as a late document that is essentially describing mythical history rather than real history, it makes it challenging to have that kind of discussion. But at least there's more ground there than, say, I would have with the Jehovah's Witness when it comes to the wills of Christ.
Right. And I also thought it would be helpful because when he originally proposed an emotional topic like biblical slavery or warfare in the Old Testament, these can be emotional topics to discuss even for Catholics and Christians to discuss what is the proper way to interpret these sorts of passages. So it just becomes very unwieldy when your interlocutor doesn't even have common ground on Christ or the existence of God. So you're right. I felt that this would be also more manageable in that we have more common ground and it's not as emotional as a topic. We're saying, okay, is this document reliable? But you're right, though, we're still pretty far apart because between my position and John's position, you could have the middle ground, which is, well, I think Luke is a good historian and describes a lot of things, but I don't think the miracles happened. You know, there's probably a lot of scholars who would support Luke, at least in the natural things reports, but maybe they reject the supernatural. But yeah, so we were still pretty far apart. But
you could have people who think that Jesus is a real historical figure and Luke is trying to record accurate history and he's just terrible at it.
Right. Yeah. You could also, there's a lot of different positions. So we were somewhat far apart, but I don't think too far apart to discuss the question of what makes something historically reliable or not. But before we go to that, maybe you could just expand a little because some people may not be as familiar with what mythicism actually is, that it would strike them as a very surprising thing. And it is surprising to believe Jesus didn't exist, but it has some vociferous defenders, especially on the internet.
Yeah, so mythicism is a position that is actually not at all common in scholarship. You have scholars who are Catholic and Protestant and Jewish and agnostic and atheist who are New Testament scholars, and almost without exception, they will say, oh yeah, Jesus is a real historical individual. And the Gospels are trying to tell us things about his life. But there has been, at least in the last couple of centuries, a handful of people who have claimed that Jesus is no more a real historical individual than Apollo or Thor or some other ancient divinity from the ancient world, mm-hmm. and that there was no real historical individual known as Jesus of Nazareth. This position had a little bit of a brief flowering in the 1800s, and then it got eclipsed. It was never prominent, but it was at least there in the 1800s, and then it sort of got eclipsed for a very long time. But then in the early 21st century, it began to gain an advocacy, especially on the internet, which has been a home that's allowed a variety of different views that are not particularly popular to have a following. Flat Earth is another example.
Right.
You know, that was not very popular for a long time, but today there are actually quite a number of Flat Earth supporters on the internet. And in the same way, other viewpoints that are not taken seriously by the scholarly community have been able to gain traction on the internet.
I do feel the Flat Earth people are... they really have taken an intellectually lazy route because everybody knows that the earth is actually hollow. It's not flat. And there's a Kingdom of Monsters at the center
and
of it.
And we're living on the inside. Yes, that is one of the viewpoints, the Hollow Earth, and we are on the inside view.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you have these views, and but it's simply there are a few individuals, maybe like I can count on my hand, that have relevant PhDs who endorse this. But I think Bart Ehrman, in his book, Did Jesus Exist?, said that it's virtually every expert on the planet says Jesus did exist. But even still, I think that made it, you could tell in the dialogue that I had with John, and I think it was helpful that he sort of embodied, and it's helpful for listeners to see how I interacted with him, because I think that what he embodied is a very common view of the Gospels, and one that we have to understand people will have when we're engaging them, which is kind of a guilty until proven innocent mentality, in that simply because it is the Bible, it's talking about as if it's one book, that it should be presumed to be false or not historical unless something else proves it. And it's given a lot of skepticism, whereas other books are not given that same kind of skepticism. And that's a double standard I tried to share with John in our dialogue to show I think that this is happening and it's not an appropriate way to look at these texts. Is that something you also see sometimes in dialogues like this?
Well, it's not just unique to him. And by the way, I had not seen him before, but he came across as a really nice guy.
Oh, yeah. So, I thought he was great.
So I thought that was a very nice aspect of your discussion with him. But he does have this guilty until proven innocent when it comes to the historical reliability of New Testament texts approach. And that's not unique to him. You actually see that a lot in secular scholarship, where the New Testament gets treated in a way, or the Old Testament for that matter, but the Bible gets treated in a way that's different than other works of ancient literature. So if someone is, say, reading a Roman historian like Suetonius, let's say, and Suetonius in the Lives of the Caesars says, well, under this Caesar, this battle occurred, they will take that at face value. Now, they're going to critically examine Suetonius, and they're not going to believe everything he says, but they're going to be open to, okay, well, here we have a piece of evidence that this battle occurred. They're not going to automatically dismiss it unless they can find confirmation from whoever the opponents of the Romans were.
Right.
Unless we can find a German source, we're not going to believe that Caesar had this battle with the Germans. The fact that it's a Roman historian writing is sufficient to at least present us with evidence that this happened.
Right.
But what you find a lot of skeptical folks doing is saying, well, okay, here the Bible says something happened, but unless we can find the same thing confirmed from people outside the Bible, We're not gonna credit this. We're just gonna dismiss it automatically rather than treating it as evidence. And in the mythicist community, that gets taken to a kind of extreme that goes beyond even what's typical in a lot of skeptical scholarship.
Yeah. Well, I find it to be, it's frustrating, and that's why I think we need to let people know about this so they can be aware of the double standard, that a system is set up. In the dialogue, I used the expression, heads I win, tails you lose, to mean you set up a system where the mythicist or the extremely critical hypothesis can't be falsified. So for example, John brought this up that, for John, like no matter how many times I could bring up that Luke gets something right, or that he gets something many other historians disagree with, well, that's to be expected of someone who's trying to write historical fiction. They're going to get a lot of history right, but it's still fiction. No, I guess what ends up happening is, no matter how many times it's proved right, that's not good enough. And any single apparent difficulty or error is enough to torpedo the whole ship, which to me, I think, is an unfair standard, that if you applied that, and I think this is another theme that we should bring up when engaging people on, is the Bible reliable? If you use that standard for any other ancient work, you would destroy ancient historiography. No other book could meet these unrealistic standards that are set for the Bible. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I would agree. Also, I even started a list after I watched the discussion of, I didn't finish it, but let's see if we can list the different types of double standards that are in play, because there were a number of them. Mm-hmm. For example, one of his desiderata, one of the things that he was desiring to see Luke do in order to credit him as a historian, is mentioning himself in the text.
Right.
And you pointed out, well, Luke does that in Acts. We have the we passages, but then those are dismissed as a kind of literary fiction.
Let's talk about those
before we get there, though.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
He's dismissing those where Luke does mention himself and saying, well, that's a literary device. That's not really Luke. That's not accurate. Luke's not claiming to be here, really. And then he looks at other passages and says, well, Luke's not mentioning himself here. So it's like, well, dude, you can't have it both ways.
Right.
Either if Luke mentions himself, you got to credit that, and you can't then say he never mentions himself when he patently does. And incidentally, and we can go to the we passages, but incidentally, that's not the only place Luke mentions himself. He also mentions himself in the prefaces to both the Gospel and Acts.
Right.
So Luke clearly does mention himself in the text, as if that mattered.
Right.
This is another one of my concerns about the viewpoint he was expressing. Historians do not have to mention themselves in their works.
Right.
That's not true of modern historians. It's not true of ancient historians. They don't have to inject themselves into what they're describing.
Right. And sometimes even when you look at ancient historians, for example, when Josephus in the Jewish War, when he's describing events that include himself, he refers to himself in the third person. So that can show also that even someone who's an eyewitness talking about themselves, let's say Matthew, there's no strangeness in them using the third person as opposed to the first. But speaking of the first person, this was an interesting point that I think got glossed over that our listeners might benefit more from hearing about, which is saying, okay, well, why should we trust Luke? Well, who were Luke's sources? If Luke had proximate contact with Paul, as in being a traveling companion and getting a lot of sources from there, among others, well, that places him in a good place to relay to us historical facts about the early church and also about Jesus's ministry, because Paul knew the apostles. And so one of those are these we passages in Acts. So maybe you can tell us more about those and some of the debates surrounding them.
So the we passages are a variety of different sections in the book of Acts where Luke uses the second person plural, first person pronoun, the first person pronoun plural we. He'll say, we left from this city and we came to this city and we did this.
Right.
And so he's talking as if he's part of a group that was actually on this journey, that was, they left from a certain place, they arrived at a certain place, and they did certain things. And prima facie, you know, in any narrative you're reading, just on the face of it, you see someone say things like, we left and we arrived and we did this, you're understanding that the author of the narrative is saying, I was there, I was part of this group that did this.
Right.
And that's not really in dispute. The question is, it's not in dispute. Should text be read like that? The question is, are we meant to take it seriously? And in the last little while, there have been a handful of scholars who've said, well, this is a literary device from the time. It's not meant to be taken literally. It's like if I say we've got an important person coming, so let's roll out the red carpet, I don't mean that there's a literal red carpet we Right. should roll out. And in the same way, Luke doesn't really mean that he was present in these we passages. They'll say that this was a common way, particularly in connection with sea voyages,
Right.
of describing voyages over the sea. And it was just meant for literary effect, but it's not meant to be taken literally. Mm-hmm. The problem is, and there are actually several, we won't obviously have time to go through them all, but among the problems with this view is when you look at the ancient texts that they'll cite to try to show that this was a real trope in ancient literature, that it falls apart. You do not find this in historical works where it is intended as fiction. It's also Luke doesn't just do it when they're traveling on the sea. Mm-hmm. And Luke doesn't do it consistently through the book. Paul goes on three major missionary journeys. Really, you can count it as four, counting his final trip to Rome.
Right.
And Luke does not do this all the way through Paul's voyages. He completely is not present. There are no we passages in what's called the first missionary journey. There is a little bit of we in the second missionary journey. There's a lot of we passages in the third missionary journey and then in Paul's final trip to Rome. Mm-hmm. So if this were just a standard trope you would use for vividness when you have a travel narrative or a sea voyage, why isn't Luke using it all the time? Why does he not have it there in the first missionary journey, not till towards the end of the second missionary journey, and then it's more consistent thereafter? It looks like the second missionary journey is when Luke first met Paul.
Right.
And that's why he starts using we there and not before.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I'm really excited for you to be able to share about this, because it happens in these dialogues. You'll be on one subject and then quickly you run to something else and it doesn't get the treatment that it deserves. So you're right. I think it was Vernon Robbins who argued for this motif back in the 70s, but later research by Susan Prater and others shows what you've just mentioned, that it's not a universal kind of trope and we have all these other problems. Although Gleason, I believe, he was actually, I don't even think he was familiar with Robbins's sea voyage motif research. He seemed to be citing the New Testament scholar Dennis MacDonald, who claims that Mark and Luke are not trying to write history. They're actually repurposing Greek fiction to sound like the life of Christ. And so when you look in Acts chapter 27, where you have all these wee passages in the famous shipwreck narrative, when Paul's on his way to Rome and gets shipwrecked on Malta, he tries to say, well, this is just Luke taking something in the Odyssey and putting it in this new context. I'm sure you can have thoughts on this, but one thought that appears to me when people make...
Yeah, I want a psych. If that's what Luke's doing, I want it the Cyclops.
Right. I'm like, where are the monsters? You know? But yeah, the problem here is that Samuel Sandmills in the 1960s, the Society of Biblical Literature, called this parallelomania, you know, trying to find parallels when they don't exist. And also, life has parallels. I mean, I could tell a story about going on a road trip across the country, and someone later could maybe make an argument that I'm actually repurposing National Lampoon's Vacation, you know, because when people go on road trips, they get conned at tourist traps, they lose things, they get lost. When people try to say the sea voyages in Acts are, oh, well, that's Luke copying the Odyssey. Well, but people also went on sea voyages in the ancient world, and you would expect things like storms to happen or shipwrecks or things like that, which were fairly common. I just find those kind of arguments really weak and tenuous when they're put forward. I don't know about it. I'm sure you feel the same.
Yeah. In order to claim that one author is copying from another, you need more than just there's a similarity of topic. If I write a term paper on, let's say, I don't know, cellular mitosis, which is how cells divide. If I write a term paper on mitosis in a biology class, that doesn't mean I'm cribbing from some other student. The teacher may have assigned all of us to write that paper, or may have assigned the previous semester, or will assign it again next semester. Just because you have a similar topic doesn't mean you can claim one person is plagiarizing another.
Right. And what really amazed me that I mentioned in the book is that the details Luke gives, especially in Acts 27 about the shipwreck, I think it makes more sense the we passages, is that he vividly recalls these things happening. And he tells us details that are things we wouldn't expect someone writing decades later who didn't have intimate knowledge of the area to communicate. For example, I believe Luke said that the time they were journeying to Rome, it was dangerous to be on the seas. That there was a point where if you went after, like in September, it was dangerous, and after November, it was impossible.
Right. That's the end of the sailing season. Because of how stormy the Mediterranean gets, there is in the ancient world, there was a season where after which you didn't sail, and then you had to wait over the winter before you could pick up again in the spring.
Right.
There are other details in that same narrative that suggest personal memory to me rather than invention. Some details like the healing of Publius's father on Malta. This just does not read. It reads like something a doctor would be interested in, but it doesn't read like something an ordinary person would make up, especially the details of what's going on with Publius's father.
And that's why when John asked me, what do you think of Luke? Like, what is the Gospel of Luke to you for its reliability? My assessment of it is that I think Luke and Acts read like a doctor who is doing his best to be a historian. That we see someone who is intelligent, learned, skilled in a trade, and applies that same analytical thinking to another field, which would be historiography. And so, yeah, when you read the Gospel of Luke, it's fascinating. He uses, for example, while the other Gospel authors will describe ailments generically, Luke will use the precise terminology from the medical manuals of his time, referring to dropsy, the correct plural noun for fevers, and like the healing that you mentioned there on Malta. Oh, the other thing with the sailing, the reason I brought that up is that Luke tells us it was after the Day of the Atonement, and so it was dangerous to travel, which if you calculated back to the year when that probably took place, would have placed it around in October. So it all lines up. And that for me is like, hey, when you see him get things more and more right, I should count for him, not against him.
My favorite example of Luke displaying the fact that he's a doctor occurs in the healing of the woman with a hemorrhage.
Yes.
Because if you read Mark, which Luke is using for this account, Mark has this very harsh statement where he says that the woman has had this hemorrhage for 12 years and she spent all her money on physicians, but she got worse rather than better.
Right.
And that makes it, that's not a very flattering thing to say about physicians. She spent all her money on them and she actually got worse.
Right.
Well, Luke changes that to, she's had this hemorrhage for 12 years and none could heal her. So you can see he's being a little defensive about his profession there.
Yeah, he's like, give us a break, Mark. We've got a lot to handle and not much materials to work with. No, absolutely. And that also explains that seeing, and this goes back to what's interesting is John didn't really challenge me on this in the dialogue that it was Luke the physician, a companion of Paul, who wrote the gospel.
He did say, I mean, he thought that Luke was written by the at earliest by 93.
Right. He used a late date argument.
So he's using late date. But you're right. He didn't too much challenge the idea that this is an actual companion of Paul.
Let's talk a little bit about the synoptic problem. That came up at the beginning of the dialogue, and we're talking about Luke and the sources he used and if he's reliable. And I did my best to explain the issues of the Synoptic Gospels and then move into the discussion. But it might be helpful for you to give people another overview or help them see how the issue of what's called the Synoptic Problem factors into the reliability of the Gospels.
Yeah, I was kind of a little startled when he first mentioned this, because you were describing your view of Luke as a reliable historian, and then he says, well, then how do you explain the synoptic problem?
And yeah, I was taking it back too.
What does the synoptic problem have to do with whether Luke uses his sources reliably or not?
Because, well, he took it to mean like it's a problem for my position, but it's not.
Well, but anyone who's competent in this area would know that it's not, the term synoptic problem is not understood that way.
Right.
Problem in this case means essentially puzzle,
right,
or issue. It's like this is something that scholars are trying to figure out. That doesn't mean it's damaging to anyone's position. It's just a puzzle. How do we explain the material that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all have in common?
Right.
Synoptic is a word. It comes from Greek roots that means seeing together. And if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they see the ministry of Jesus in a very similar way in the way they present it. John presents it from a different viewpoint, so that's why he's not a synoptic. But it's clear that there are some kind of common links between the three synoptic gospels to explain why they present Jesus' ministry in the way they do. And there have been a number of different solutions proposed. There's actually a startlingly large number of solutions that have been proposed. But most scholars today would say, okay, Mark was the first gospel to be written, and then Matthew and Luke used Mark. And then they have some other material in common, about 235 verses, and there's more of a range of views about how to explain these 235 verses that that Matthew and Luke have in common. Now, I was interested to see what he did with that. He advocated a position known as the Farrar hypothesis. This view is actually somewhat common in British New Testament scholarship, but not outside of Britain. Farrar was a British New Testament scholar, and the basic idea of the Farrar hypothesis is Mark wrote first, Matthew then expanded on Mark, and then Luke took bits of Matthew, like those 235 verses, and other verses from Mark. So you have Mark first, Matthew second, Luke third.
Right.
That's not my personal favorite. My favorite is what's known as the Wilkie hypothesis, which flips the order of the other two Gospels. So I tend to want to say Mark wrote first, Luke expanded on Mark, and then Matthew drew on both Luke and Mark. Neither one of those is the most common in New Testament scholarship today. The most common view is what's called the Q hypothesis, also known as the two-source hypothesis, which says that there was another work that's now lost called Q, from the German word Quelle, which means source, imaginative naming. And Mark wrote first, and then both Matthew and Luke independently drew on both Mark and Q. And one of the reasons that these scholars will say this or propose this is that Matthew and Luke's infancy narratives are very, very different. Now, actually, they fit together really well. And I don't think this is the explanation, but they'll say, you know, Matthew and Luke's infancy narratives look quite different. That could be explained if neither Matthew nor Luke knows the other is writing. So they're writing independently of each other. And that would be an interesting point to pose to John, because part of his case rests on the idea of Matthew copying from Luke, but that's actually not the majority opinion in New Testament scholarship. The majority opinion is they didn't know about each other.
And that's why I asked him, because he brought up the differences in the birth narratives as if this was a irreconcilable contradiction and problem, to which I said, well, if Matthew was copying Luke, why did he create this problem in the first place if he's using him as this kind of source? And which I also posted to him that I felt like he said... Now, I think he clarified to say, this is my position, not the position.
He did.
But I think it was important for me to propose that, because the way he was speaking would make it seem like to the listeners, well, scholars agree it's Mark, Luke, what was, so he was Ferrer.
Mark, Matthew, Luke.
So Luke would be last, to which I said, well, other people say like Wilkie, no, it would be Matthew would be last. And then you have, you know, to let him know, hey, there's other positions on this. And whichever one you take, it doesn't really address the core issue of whether any particular gospel, Luke especially, is reliable or not, because you can be reliable and gather sources in a variety of different ways.
That brings up a point I wanted to make. One of the things he wanted to see Luke do in order to credit him as a reliable historian is to see Luke citing his sources, you know, telling us where he got this material. And I had a couple of thoughts about that.
Sure.
The first one is that's something you find in academic histories. It is not guaranteed at all. If you're reading a popular history, it is not guaranteed at all that you will see sources cited. And that's true today. If you read a popular history of the Civil War or something like that, you very frequently will not find sources cited. It's also true of ancient history. I was reading part of Suetonius' Life of Vespasian, Emperor Vespasian, earlier today, and he's talking about these things that happened to Vespasian, and he's not telling me any of the sources. So it was not at all guaranteed either in a modern history or an ancient history, that you're going to have source citation. However,
right.
Luke actually does. This is the second point of three. Luke sure. actually does tell us his sources. In the prologue to the gospel, he tells his patron Theophilus that I'm writing you an orderly account of what has been accomplished among us, as has been handed down from eyewitnesses and ministers of the word.
Right.
So he's thinking of two classes of people that he's getting information from. One are eyewitnesses, and the second is ministers of the word, meaning people who were not eyewitnesses, but who have been authorized right. to go talk about this message. And so that's, in general terms, those are Luke's sources. Eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. He also has written sources because he's obviously copying from Mark. He doesn't tell us that, but it's clear that he is copying from Mark. And right. then, even within the gospel, he periodically identifies who a source is. This happens twice in the infancy narratives, mm-hmm. where he's talking about Jesus's birth and his childhood, and twice he says, "And Mary treasured these things in her heart." Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't just to like give us a warm fuzzy about Mary.
Right.
The purpose of him saying Mary remembered this is to tell us how Luke knows this. Right. So Luke is citing his source. He either talked to Mary directly, or he talked to someone who did talk to Mary directly. But one way or another, Mary is the source of this information.
Right.
So and it's not just there. He does similar things elsewhere. Richard Baucom, in his book Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, has a really fascinating proposal, which I think is correct, that the reason various figures get names in the gospel, like Jairus, whose daughter gets raised, is because they became Christian. And they would right. then, whereas other people who don't get names, like some random blind man that gets healed, well, he didn't become a Christian, so he didn't stay in the Christian community and repeat what happened to him, and so they didn't remember his name.
Right.
But someone like Jairus became a Christian and would talk about what Jesus did for his daughter, and that's how the gospel writers know about him and his name. Hmm. The third thing I wanted to mention, though, is in terms of, does Luke use his sources reliably? Is we've got a great test case here. I mean, I don't need Luke to tell me the source. If I can see Luke is using Mark, well, then let's just ask, how well does Luke use Mark? I mean, he may change phrasing here and there or a little detail yeah. here and there, but the gist of what Mark is saying, and often the very wording of Mark, is obvious in Luke, and that suggests that Luke uses his sources responsibly. He's not changing them around willy-nilly. And if we can show he's doing that for Mark, then that would suggest that's his procedure when he's using a source. He conveys the gist of it accurately and mm-hmm. doesn't feel the liberty to change it willy-nilly.
Well, then I have my three thoughts now on your three thoughts.
Okay.
First, yes, about Suetonius, that was interesting because in preparation for the dialogue, I read a previous essay that I know John was familiar with by Matthew Ferguson, saying, well, here's how ancient history is different than the Gospels. And ancient historians, if there's a contradiction between them and another author, they explain why they're different. No, that doesn't happen, because when you read the account of Emperor Vespasian healing the blind man and the lame man, Tacitus and Suetonius, you get very different vibes from it. Or at least Tacitus, it comes off a lot more, he's probably faking this, whereas Suetonius seems a lot more neutral. But you have the contradiction there, and neither tries to resolve with each other. The second point, on the using the sources correctly, that's why I felt there's that double standard where John or other skeptics will say, oh, look at these other secular historians, and they cite their sources, and Luke doesn't do that. And one example we brought up was Arian of Alexandria. His epic biography of Alexander the Great, called the Anabasis of Alexander. And he, you know, John says, well, you know, he cites Polybius, he cites Aristobulus in his preface. This is where I got the sources. To which I asked him, well, do we have those documents? He said, well, no, we don't. then we don't really know if he faithfully cited them or not. Whereas that's a good point you raised. We have Mark, actually. We have independent manuscripts from Luke, so we can compare and test Luke. We can't test Arrian and how well he used these different sources. And the third, so that's two. The third point we can maybe go a little back and forth on about the made-up name, the names. I think Bauckham is also right that names are preserved because those people later became known in the Christian community. This is also in Mark, the children of Simon who carried Peter's cross, Rufus and Alexander. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think there's a Rufus eminent in the Lord in Romans, I think. Right?
There, I would have to do checking on that. However, we can reasonably infer that Rufus was someone known to the Romans because that's the audience for Mark's gospel.
Yes. Oh, it's right here, Romans 16:13. And when Paul is ending his epistle, he tells them to greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord. So he might. The reason we have the name of Mark, he might be the same person.
Well, and there's a good argument that he would be, because Mark, the information we have is that Mark was written at Rome for a Roman audience, and
right.
So the people in Rome knew who Rufus and Alexander were, the sons of the guy that carried Jesus' cross. And in Romans, where Paul is doing the personal greetings at the end, Paul has never actually been to Rome at this point. And so he's saying hello to lots of people. I mean, he's got this, it's the biggest list of all the greetings in all of the Pauline epistles.
Right.
You've got the biggest right here at the end of Romans. And how did he get these names? Well, he did know people who had been in Rome, like Priscilla and Aquila.
Right.
He also knew the scribe of Romans, a guy named Tertius. And Paul is in, at the time he's writing Romans, he's in Corinth, and Tertius, in the middle of the greeting, says, "I, Tertius, who wrote down this epistle, also salute you." And so that tells us both that Tertius was known to the Romans, otherwise who's this random nabob saying hello to us?
Right.
And that he was with Paul in Corinth, but apparently had been in Rome and was known to the Christian community in Rome. And when you look at the structure of Paul's greetings to the Romans, he proceeds through them in a way that they fall into chunks, and it looks like there's something like six chunks here.
Right.
And the proposal, which I think is actually very good, is that these are the house churches of Rome in AD 54, that that Tertius or Priscilla and Aquila have been in contact with Paul, Tertius most immediately because he's writing the letter, and he's able to tell Paul, yeah, we've got these six Christian churches in Rome, and here are the names of the principal people involved in them. And so Paul just goes and greets all of those people because
right.
he's coming to Rome, he's planning on coming to Rome, he wants them to welcome him, and so he's making nice with them before he even gets there.
And I think that all makes sense. And I was actually,
with Rufus being mentioned here and in Romans, Rufus is not a hugely common name. So to find more than one Rufus in the Christian community in Rome in the mid first century, when both of these books were written, it would be improbable. So I would, if I had to guess, I'd guess they are the same Rufus.
Yeah. So it's always hard when you do dialogues like this with someone. And I looked over his previous videos and also the essays and articles that John cited in those videos from other skeptical scholars. It's always hard because you want to be prepared and there's lots of different topics people could bring up. Some of them were interesting. This did not come up in the dialogue, but I was interested in it because in a previous video, John had said Luke is not a good historian, claiming that he invented people's names. So in the Road to Emmaus narrative, when Jesus appears to the two men on the road to Emmaus, one of whom is named Cleopas, the claim, and this goes back to Richard Carrier, I think, is that, well, no, this is fictional. Cleopas is a made-up name, a Greek compound that means report all, give glory to all. And so it's just a symbolic name for a symbolic story. And that's that versus saying the name was preserved because this person was an important individual in the church. And I know you probably have a lot of thoughts on this, but for me, that just screams the etymological fallacy. Instead of more mundane explanations for what this name is and its origin.
Yeah, so there is a figure who is found elsewhere in the Gospels named Clopas. Mm-hmm. And we know that it was very common for people in the first century Jewish community to have a Jewish name and also a Gentile name, like John Mark. You know, John is his Jewish name. Marcus was his Roman name.
Or Saul and Paul.
Well, that's where I was going to go next. Yeah. Frequently, the names would be picked based on they sound similar. So the figure who we know as Paul, mm-hmm. Paulus in Latin, Paulus sounds like Shaul. At least they're similar in sound. And so that's why Saul is known as Paul. And we see the same thing in our culture today. You know, you may have someone from China. Their name kind of starts with a D sound. And in America, when they're doing business, they chose to be known as David or something like that because it's a more familiar name. It lets them interact with people more easily. Well, so there is this other figure in the Gospels who's a man named Clopas, and we know about his family relations. Well, Cleophas is one vowel different.
Right.
From Clopas. And the standard understanding is that Cleophas or Clopas is the same guy. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, in terms of this being a made-up name, I don't know where Carrier thinks he's getting his information, but it's not. There has been a study of the technical name for this kind of study is onomastics, which means the study of names. And even though Clopas or Cleophas is an uncommon name.
Right.
It is not unknown. It does not just appear in the Gospels. We also have an ossuary that has the name on it. And so this is not simply a made-up name. This is one that's out there. It wasn't a common name, but it is not simply made up by Luke.
Right. And another possibility is that Cleopas is a nickname or a shortened name for something like Cleopatras. Which is, you know, people had common names also. They're not made up, like glory to the father. Well, people had very religious, all of the names are essentially have, many of them have religious meanings and connotations to them. So I guess I have 2 points on that. One, if you did take this argument really far, you could argue that in ancient Judaism, the Messiah and stars often have a connection. And so therefore, Simon Bar Kokhba, which means Simon, son of the star, who was a messianic claimant in the early second century in the second Jewish war. Well, he didn't exist. It's a made-up name, Simon, son of the star. No, people had all different kinds of names then.
The idea that someone's name should be dismissed just because it has a meaning is a modern anachronism. In English, in the contemporary world, people don't really remember what their names mean. They don't have significance. But in the ancient world, they had lots of significance. And in fact, they would get assigned names that were characteristic of the person. Like, for example, I mean, not only do we have these, they're called theophoric names, where you have the name of a god embedded in the name, like Don El, Daniel. It means God El is my judge.
Right.
That's extremely common, and not just among the Israelites, among the Egyptians, for example. Tutankhamun, Amun was a god, so Tutankhamun, Tutankhamun, means image of the living god Aten. So it's very common in the ancient Near East, but also in Greco-Roman circles. A common slave name was Christus, because Christos in Greek means useful. And if you've bought a slave, you want him to be useful to you. So you give him the name Christos. And so people in the ancient world were just used to having names having meaning.
Right. And so the name, one, it has meaning. That's not a reason to dismiss it or say it's fictionalized. But number two, also it could be nicknames were common then as they are now. So Cleopatras could be Cleopas. Much the same as I believe that you have Herod Antipater. He'd be the son of Herod the Great, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Also,
but who was also known as Herod Antipas?
Yeah, and one of the things, now there are different types of nicknames. Mm-hmm. One type of nickname gives a description of a person, like one of the apostles is James HaMikros, which means James the Little, mm-hmm. or James the Younger. And there you've like tacked on to his name, the HaMikros, to tell us something about him. He's little or younger compared to the other James. The other kind of nickname is where you just shorten the right. name. And an example of that, or kind of slur it around a little bit and modify it, an example of that would be Lazarus, which is a simplification of Azariah. And or in English, you know, even though my legal name is Jimmy,
right.
Jimmy is just a variation on James for most people. And so that's a somewhat different kind of nickname. But yeah, you see that a lot where in ancient literature, both ancient Near Eastern and Greco-Roman, where someone has a longer name and then they'll just kind of mush the name up a little bit. And so Cleopatras into Cleophas, that could easily happen.
Right. Well, this has been an excellent exchange. I'm excited for people to go deeper into this subject. I think biblical scholarship and being able to provide historical reliability for our faith that is rooted in history, it's so important. It's why I did this dialogue, and I want people to keep learning about all these resources. My little guy walked in. I think it's time for dinner at the Horn household. So, Jimmy, tell our listeners a little bit more where they can find out more about your work, and maybe if you have any resources you'd recommend on this subject.
Okay, so like Trent, I work for Catholic Answers. You can find a lot of stuff there at Catholic.com. Also, my personal website, JimmyAiken.com. I have a lot of additional stuff there. It's J-I-M-M-Y, and then my last name is so easy. It's only four letters, A-K-I-N, as in Nancy. So Aiken, JimmyAiken.com. And also check out podcasts like Trent. I'm on Catholic Answers Live, Catholic Answers Focus. And perhaps my best known podcast is Jimmy Aiken's Mysterious World, where we look at natural and supernatural mysteries from the twin perspectives of faith and reason.
Very good.
And one of the things that came up in your discussion was infancy narratives. And,
oh, yes.
And Matthew's is quite different from Luke's. I actually, a while back, wrote a blog post where I show how they integrate with each other and why they're different. If you're interested in that, it's at JimmyAiken.com, but you can find it quickly just by Googling how the accounts of Jesus's childhood fit together. So, Jimmy Aiken, how the accounts of Jesus's childhood fit together, and it'll come right up.
Very good. I'd also recommend a resource for our listeners who want to dive deeper into this. There's, of course, my book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties. Another good book, if you want to go deeper, this is The Historical Reliability of the Gospels by Craig Blumberg, more of a semi-academic treatment. He has another one also on the Gospel of John. And then we also have other resources, of course, at Catholic.com. So, Jimmy, thanks so much for being on the Council of Trent today.
My pleasure.
All right. And thank you guys for listening. And I hope you all have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.